Welcome to Scratched Up Radio Theater. I'm Jim Dowling of the Scratched Up Radio Players, and tonight I have the privilege of bringing you something different. Tonight we'll be going back in time, taking a look at World War II through the words of the late and honorable Richard B. Eaton, Judge Eaton of Reading. And the voice of Judge Eaton will be from Bob Christensen of the Scratched Up Radio Players, bringing you the latest episode. And we hope you'll stick around afterwards because we have an interview with Roger Longnecker of Reading, who is a historian and knows an awful lot about Eaton and is going to tell us some things that we do not know. So hang around. And without further ado, let's get on with the show. Why don't you sit back and enjoy now?
Good afternoon, my sons and daughters, and thank you for your warm welcome. I have been asked to do something today that is out of the ordinary for me, as it is not my habit to talk about myself, but my historian friends have convinced me that I would be remiss were I not to pass along a few stories about my experiences while serving in World War II. When I enrolled at Stanford University in 1930, I also joined the Reserve Officers Training Corps. By doing so, when I graduated, not only would I receive my bachelor's degree, I would also be commissioned as a second lieutenant in the Army Reserves. However, I could not receive my commission then as I was too young. I had to wait 1.5 years until I turned 21 years of age. By the time I completed my bachelor's degree in engineering, I had decided to change direction. For my graduate work, I attended the Stanford Law School, from which I graduated in 1938. I passed the state bar examination in that same year and received my license to practice law in November. Returning to Reading, I clerked for Jesse W. Carter, Esquire, until Mr. Carter was appointed to the state Supreme Court. I then became an associate in the office of Glenn D. Newton, Esquire, for a time, and in 1939 I opened my own practice. Throughout this time, I was active in the Army Reserve. By 1940, with the German invasion of France, it was clear that the Army needed to build up stores of armaments in anticipation that war might be imminent. In normal times, the Army Ordnance Service would manufacture and maintain these materials until needed, but these were not normal times, so the Army began to gear up to contract with civilian industrial firms to provide the materials with which to wage war. I had been in contact with the War Department, and in the fall of 1940, I closed my office and went on active duty. I was sent to camp for training, after which I was promoted to first lieutenant and assigned as the head of the legal section for the Ordnance Service for the San Francisco District. During the 1.5 years that I served in this capacity, we wrote in excess of 200 contracts with various manufacturers worth several million dollars. I was also promoted to the rank of captain. After Pearl Harbor, because I was single and had no others depending on me, I felt it was my duty to volunteer to serve overseas. In the summer of 1942, I was assigned to General Eisenhower's command and sent to East Africa, and hence to Northern Africa, Sicily, and Italy. We shipped out from Staten Island for Rio de Janeiro, and from there on to Cape Town, South Africa, where we spent a few days. From Cape Town, we went on to Aden in Arabia, and thence to Port Tufik at the Arabian end of the Suez Canal. In all, the voyage took 42 days, cruising some 23,000 miles on a ship carrying 7,000 American troops and a few hundred British. I was ordered to duty at Eritrea, Ethiopia. The British had kicked the Italian army out, and in their haste to leave, the Italians left a large amount of military supplies behind. We were to reclaim those supplies and send them north to the British 8th Army. We located and reactivated 10 different shops. We had shops working on tires, batteries, trucks, a foundry making tow chains, one processing industrial gases, another making gasoline cans, and other specialty shops. Now, when I say we, our detachment was comprised of 8 officers and 42 enlisted men, and we employed 1,200 Italian civilians and 1,800 Ethiopian natives. In 5 months, we sent north 2 large shiploads of machine stores and 250 truckloads of industrial stores. I was very comfortable in my relations with the Ethiopians. We worked and got along well together. Before leaving there for my next assignment, they presented me with a ceremonial sword. The story has it that the sword is of British origins and dates from the 16th or 17th century. It is hanging on the wall of my study to this day. Next, General Eisenhower sent me to the headquarters for the 15th Army Group at Tunisia. This group commanded the British 8th Army and the American 7th Army, which was later known as Patton's Army. It was the 15th that was to conduct the Sicily invasion, but they were still in the process of completing their campaign against the Germans at Tunis. This, of course, affected the timeline for the invasion. When word reached headquarters that the campaign in Tunis was over, I was detached and sent forward to locate, guard, and plan the utilization of the captured German materiel. Now, we had been eating Spam frequently for quite a while, and frankly, we were a little tired of it. You can imagine our delight when we discovered that we had captured a large quantity of German sausage, which, as ordered, we guarded well and carefully planned their utilization. The invasion of Sicily was one of the shortest campaigns of the war, lasting only 38 days before the Germans retreated to the mainland. I was assigned to the island base section and given the job of rounding up whatever industrial resources that might exist. What I discovered was that there were fewer industrial resources in Sicily than in the Gerlinger foundry in Reading. The only industrial order of any size ever produced in Sicily was 600 sewer grates for the streets of Palermo. All else were repair jobs. Now, in Sicily, we had grasped from the beginning that food was short, so we did not eat civilian supplies at all. We brought in our own food and provided that all kitchen discards should be boiled in large, new, clean garbage cans and distributed as hot soup to the beggars at our kitchen door. We discovered that the discards of a company of 212 men would feed 100 beggars. During the worst of winter, we put out an order that the troops could not grind out their cigarettes on their plates. Even table scraps were boiled and served as soup. There was an orphanage close by that cared for some 100 children. They were fortunate as they had a big garden and 2 cows, but that was not enough. I tried to alleviate some of the shortages by giving them my PX rations and some cash. During the holidays, I managed to scrape up enough cookies and candies to give each child a treat on Christmas Day. At the end of the Sicily campaign, the Cardinal Archbishop of Palermo came to our commanding general to ask if he would have any objections to the reinstitution of Boy Scouting. The general had none and offered to send representatives of the army who were scouters to the ceremony. I was one of the representatives. The ceremony was held at the ancient cathedral of Palermo, where, with a great ringing of bells, the participants in all of their vestments came in from the archbishop's palace across the street. Then the cardinal himself, his long red robe carried by train bearers, entered and took his place on the throne, and the ceremony began. Next came middle-aged men who 20 years before had been Boy Scouts, carrying their old troop banners, which had been hidden from the fascists for all this time. Following were groups of boys new to scouting, no uniforms, of course, as none were available, but with bright new banners their mothers had sewed from whatever cloth of the proper colors was available. After the ceremony, the scouts, old and new, paraded down the main streets of Palermo. And that was the reinstitution of Boy Scouting in Italy after 20 years of suppression. Some 25 years later, at a World Scout Jamboree, I met an Italian scoutmaster who was one of the boys at Palermo. I was not involved in the landing on the Italian mainland, but soon after I was transferred to the peninsular-based section at Naples. Now in Italy, after we had mounted the invasion of southern France, we found that we had 80,000 service troops to take care of 500,000 American and Brazilian combat troops. Being understaffed, we hired 123,000 Italians to do the kinds of work necessary to keep our troops supplied. Before long, we learned that, due to food shortages, the Italian civilians were not able to work through an entire day unless rations were supplemented. Civilian rations were 6 slices of bread a day, with a large bowl of macaroni and a large bowl of olive oil provided once a week. So we found it necessary to provide bread, hot soup, and a vegetable at noon so that the workers could last through the day. In the winter, we discovered that the civilians needed shoes and clothing. We began distributing clothing removed from casualties, but the Italians protested at being clothed in blood-stained garments with bullet holes. So we opened up a shop to clean and repair clothing and resole old shoes with patches from worn-out tires. In early summer of 1944, the Germans began retreating to the north of Rome. I was sent northward with instructions to follow as close to the front as the army would let me. As soon as I could get into a town, I was to find the mayor or other official in charge and open a labor office to hire workers to get the roads open again. You see, as the Germans retreated, they took care to demolish bridges and roads behind them, especially in hard-to-repair locations, in an effort to slow down the pursuit. A few days after I returned from this assignment, I was again sent northward and then west to the provincial capitals of Orvieto and Viterbo. What we found was that the retreating German army had abandoned their labor and ration offices so that no food had been issued to the civilian population for the previous day. From there, we headed to Rome to see what could be done about the situation. As we entered Rome, I could see the dome of St. Peter a block over. I figured the war would not be delayed too much if we drove over to see it. As we came upon St. Peter's Square, we encountered a military convoy led by a vehicle with a general's flag. When I reported, I found that it was my base section commander, who had been requested by the Pope to come to the Vatican to meet with him. Being as I was the only person there who had been north of Rome, I was asked to join him for the meeting. We were escorted through the big bronze door into the Vatican, past the Swiss guards with their halberds, and into the great throne hall over the narthex of St. Peter. Soon, Pope Pius XII entered on his traveling throne that was borne on the shoulders of 8 red brocaded footmen. The situation at the Vatican was dire, as they had stored 2 years of provisions for its normal population of 3,000. But these stores were melting away rapidly, as the Vatican was now feeding 1.25 million people. The Pope wanted to know how soon we could get the ration offices open. The general assured Pope Pius that a convoy of trucks loaded with bags of flour was following up from southern Italy and would be entering the gates of Rome that night. We would open the ration offices first thing in the morning. After a time, Pope Pius got around to me and asked about the conditions up north, to which I replied that they were about the same as in Rome, but that I was here to pick up 2 truckloads of flour and that ration offices there would also be open by morning. Pope Pius gave us his blessing, and then after a short tour of the Vatican, we left to get about our business. When the Germans pulled back from Rome, they established their lines at the Arno River just north of the port of Leghorn, which we were sent to reopen. Now at Leghorn, there was little destruction in the port area, so we established our advanced base there. We were short of manpower, so we also hired a number of women. In fact, some of our institutions there were staffed entirely by women. We soon learned that the restrooms in the port area, being mostly for men, were grossly inadequate. Before long, we received a petition from some of the women headed, "We represent 1,500 Italian women in labor." We promptly set up additional restrooms. After we'd been at Leghorn for some weeks, the German lines broke along the Arno River, and they pulled back into the Apennine Mountains to the north. At that point, the Germans were fighting the Italians as well as the Allies. Partisans would attack and assassinate at night, and the Germans could not move much during the day due to Allied air superiority. Throughout the winter of 1944-45, the Germans dug in and held their lines. That winter, the snow was 3.5 feet deep in the mountains. Normally, we allowed 3 blankets to soldiers who were in the field, but it soon became apparent that the situation was desperate in the mountains. So the base boys were stripped to 2 blankets with orders to give the combat troops 4 blankets each. In my travels, I have slept in a variety of places, curled up against a wall in a demolished church, roadside ditch banks, open fields. Never have I been as cold as I was that winter. By the spring of 1945, the war was winding down in Italy, and after the front stabilized in the Apennines, I was sent back to the base section headquarters at Naples. Once there, we were given the responsibility for the civilian laborers. Our concerns were with issues such as adjusting pay scales to reflect the increasing inflation in Italy, and how to handle the beginnings of a labor movement. Looking back, in spite of the physical burdens, the trips were much more interesting, a continual succession of new and interesting scenes. Rather suddenly, at the end of the war, General Eisenhower's command in Germany discovered that critical public works projects were badly damaged or inoperable, and that the engineers most capable of restoring them were Germans. Mostly, the Italians had cooperated with the Allies, but in Germany, it was different, as there had been a strict non-fraternization policy. Because of my experience in working with civilians and my fluency in German, I was dispatched to Germany to train other officers on how to set up and administer a civilian workforce. After numerous problems caused by weather, we finally arrived at Mainz, where General Eisenhower had set up his headquarters. After a period of 2 weeks or so, I finished delivering the training and, again hampered by bad weather, returned to Italy. Now, as far as my involvement with the war, that was that. While in Europe, I had been promoted to the rank of major. At the end of the war, I was offered another promotion and the opportunity to stay in the Army and work with the Marshall Plan. Tempting as that was, in the end, I concluded that it was time to come home, reopen my office, and reconnect with my Reading family. I had seen enough. And that would be a fact. And now, as I take my leave, my sons and daughters, I thank you for your patience and attention this afternoon. I'm sitting here today with Roger Longnecker, with whom I worked to create the monologue for the Judge Eaton presentation. This was a joint venture between Riverfront Community Theater here in Reading, along with the Shasta Historical Society and the Baron Eaton's House Museum, with whom Roger is intimately connected, the museum and the Historical Society. As a little bit of personal background, Roger, could you kind of fill us in on your background?
Sure. Lived in the county for quite some time, since 1956, and I went to Central Valley High School and went to Shasta College and was going to be in law enforcement. That was my major, administration of justice, and took a lot of history classes at Shasta, and some of the profs said, we think you should go into maybe teaching. That would be something that you might enjoy better than police work. And so I took their advice and went on to Chico, and I have a bachelor's degree in history with a minor in English. And I also went on to UC Davis. I have a master's degree in history. And I taught for 34 years at Shasta High School, teaching history and then government and economics. I also taught for Shasta College. I also taught for National University. History at Shasta College, history for National University.
What is it about Judge Eaton and his family that makes him so notable that we would devote this time to developing a history of his war years, which was little known by the general public, in other areas of his life? What was he like, and why was he so important to the community?
Richard Eaton was a very precocious child. He was born in 1914, and from a very early age, he gave promise of exceptional ability. The proof of that comes in the fact that when he graduated from Shasta High School here in 1930, he was 15 years old.
Oh, boy.
And he went to Stanford then that next fall. He was still 15 and a half. So he has a law degree. He has a law. He
Another
has a law.
Attended
Stanford starting out as an engineering, chemical engineering student, and actually changed his major before he graduated. And then he went on to law school. So he spent a totality of 8 years at Stanford. And those were very good years for him. He was in the ROTC program there. He always felt he had an obligation to his country. And he states that in a number of ways and places. And so he was in the ROTC. And because he was in engineering, or at least when he started in ROTC, he was in engineering, so he stayed in ordnance. And that was to be very important later on at the outbreak of World War II, because he was assigned to ordnance duties, not only because of his background in ordnance, but because of his legal training as well.
Now, another thing, I know that in creating this, just to kind of wrap up, he had a special feeling for Redding as his family. In reading different documents,
yes,
and letters and whatnot, his relationship seemed to be as an old bachelor who never married, never had his own children. He seemed to take on Redding as his project or something.
I think that's a fair assessment. He was sort of the unofficial official historian of Shasta County, and he was asked all the time to give speeches, to talk to groups, to tell children, schools, you know, the story, the background of Shasta County.
Mm-hmm.
One thing else, he was very active in the community, with community organizations, the Masons, the Boy Scouts, through the court, he was very active with the juvenile hall. It's actually named after him.
Mm-hmm.
And he felt that there was a tremendous responsibility on his part to educate the citizenry as to the importance of the past, how it has significantly impacted the present, and that it was something you always needed to be aware of, besides just being interesting stories to hear.
Mm-hmm.
And he told his stories very well. He had a very unique style, and it was difficult to not listen. You really wanted to pay attention.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate your coming in and filling us in a little bit. You know, we're going to go on. I think we have about five different monologues we're going to do.
Okay.
And we will do May Helene Bacon,
okay,
Boggs. Well, I think will be the next one in the series.
Good. Yeah.
Well, thank you for coming in, Roger, and sharing your experience and your knowledge of Shasta County. And as we go forward doing more of these, hopefully we can get together again and discuss some of the finer details.
Sure, sure. Thanks. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. I hope you enjoyed our show tonight. This episode was adapted from the Historic Society's 2003 edition of Covered Wagon. We'd like to extend a big thank you to Roger Langnecker for coming into the studio and all this information that he had for us. I'd like to talk to anybody out there who might be interested in sending us a script, because this is community theater. This is community radio, and we are looking for local talent. So if you might have a script, something we could adapt to radio, please send it to us at scratchedup@kkrn.org. You've been listening to KKRN Radio at 88.5 or streaming at kkrn.org. If you would like to help keep KKRN and Scratched Up Radio Theater on the air, you can go to kkrn.org and click on the donate button, or you can mail a check to KKRN P.O. Box 188, Montgomery Creek, California, 96065. If you'd like to volunteer at the station, or perhaps have your own show, call the station at area code 530-337-1101. Good night, and thank you for listening to Scratched Up Radio Theater on KKRN 88.5 FM.
Chicago way. He had a boogie style that no one else could play. He was the top man at his craft. But then his number came up and he was gone with the draft. He's in the army now, a blowing reveille. He's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. They made him blow a bugle for his Uncle Sam. It really brought him down because he couldn't jam. The captain seemed to understand. Because the next day the cap went out and drafted a band. And now the company jumps when he plays reveille. He's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. A toot, a toot, a tootie a toot. He blows it eight to the bar. In boogie rhythm, he can't blow a note unless the bass and guitar is playing with him. He makes the company jump when he plays reveille. He's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. He was a boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. And when he played boogie woogie bugle, he was dizzy as a buzz bee. And when he plays, he makes the company jump a to the bar. He's a boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. Toot 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 la da toot la da toot toot. He blows it a to the bar. He can't blow a note if the bass and guitar isn't with him. The company jumps when he plays reveille. He's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. He puts the boys to sleep with boogie every night and wakes them up the same way in the early bright. They clap their hands and stamp their feet because they know how he plays when someone gives him a beat. He really breaks it up when he plays reveille. He's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. Company B.